This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you. I'm Christy Masuera Davis, and I'm with Lannan Foundation. I'd like to welcome you all to our first event of the 2008-2009 series of Readings and Conversations. We are so happy to open this year with Isabel Allende. We've been trying, I think it's been probably 8 years to get her here. So I'm just as excited as you are. And I'd like to thank you all who got your tickets following our normal procedures. I know it was a hot ticket. I appreciate your patience. I have a favor. Those of you who have friends who did not get a ticket and didn't call me and complain and cry and yell at me, would you tell them thank you, please? So tonight's evening is actually a benefit for Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe, and I'd like to introduce... I'd like to introduce Letty Naranjo, their director, who will say a few words, and then we'll have Michael Silverblatt and then Isabel Allende. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Christy. We are so honored to be the featured nonprofit this evening. I would like to extend a heartfelt thank you to the Lannan Foundation for their continued support and for promoting literacy in the Santa Fe community. We serve approximately 600 students per year. We teach them basic literacy skills such as reading, writing, math skills, computer skills, and then also we teach English as a second language. Our volunteer tutors this last year provided over 18,000 hours of instruction, which is equivalent to over $326,000. And I would like all our volunteer tutors, our volunteer board, our advisory board, our students, and staff members to please stand and be recognized. I just have a couple of minutes, so I wanted to end with a quote from a real dear friend and the late author, Jim Sagal. He's the one that gave us a brainstorm to have our annual Evening with an Author fundraising event. And this year we will be having our 11th annual Evening with an Author. And I'd like to invite anyone who would like to attend. We're having a special ticket sale tonight only. The tickets are $100, $125 normally, but tonight, this evening, if you purchase a ticket this evening, the tickets are $100 per person. And our author is Victor Villaseñor. The event will be held on October the 11th at the Scottish Rite Masonic Center. And so please see us. We have a table in the lobby if you're interested in buying tickets this evening. Well, Jim Sagal said, books are the food of our future. Those who cannot read are going hungry, but it is our society that has started to starve. One of the greatest gifts one human being can give to another is the gift of literacy, for it will feed that person for life. Jim Sagal. Thank you.
Do I need to tell you that I'm honored to open the series? I'm thrilled to be here. I'm doubly thrilled because, you know, when Christy said that the Lannan Foundation has been trying to invite Isabel for 8 years, they asked me if I would talk to her. And I didn't know particularly whether I would be effective. And Isabel turned to me and said, "Is this something you would like to do?" And I said, "Well, yes, I would, of course." "Oh, of course I'll do it." So I'm very, very happy to have her here. Over the course of those years, Isabel and I have had many conversations together. Actually, there are 9 of them in the archive on Bookworm, and if you ever want to check them out, you will hear a whole history, because in addition to talking about her individual novels, we've done individual shows about South America and its writers, about memory and how it works in fiction, and about women and writing. Now, this brings me to the subject of my introduction. Right now, everyone is talking about 18 million cracks in a glass ceiling, yes? We all have heard about these cracks. And, you know, Isabel Allende comes from a culture, yes, where machismo, a crack in the glass ceiling, is very, very hard to make. A person has to be determined and strong and brave, all of these things. Well, in addition, she is funny. She is practical and personable. She is, in her way, a she-demon. She is sensual. She has an extraordinary gift for understanding what it is that a woman must do. Not just what she can do, but must do. I was reading a book recently. It was called Women and the New York School. The critic, Maggie Nelson, was speaking of the New York School painters and the New York School poets, and there were very few women. And she pointed out, in fact, that when a woman would step up to the plate to write a New York School poem, you know, Frank O'Hara was being praised for writing things called lunch poems. They were very casual, very fast, very brisk. And this critic pointed out, well, you know, the fact of the matter is, women are known for having lunch. When a woman writes a lunch poem, she's not particularly respected. When a man writes a lunch poem, oh, he's bringing out his feminine side. He's invoking the goddess, you know. And a woman doesn't get the opportunity. Now, from the very beginning of El Boom, when Isabel Allende appeared, all these men, they were writing the legends, the folk tales of their nation. They were opening fiction to superstition and the supernatural. But what about Isabel Allende? Oh, she's just telling stories of the abuelas and the brujas. This is her grandmother's story. These are the crones. No, no, no. This is what a woman does. No, no. And, you know, she said to me, I must be very careful. Critics would say, with any romance, oh, she is sentimental. And she discovered very early on that she could write the stories of wars and battles, of warrior women, and write of atrocities with the full violence and passion that bloodshed instills, and still she will be called a woman's writer. That somehow or other, the crack in the glass ceiling doesn't quite filter down to a woman's actual achievement, which in this case is considerable. More than 11 books, extraordinary memoirs, the ability to write, and a secondary ability to allow to be published a memoir written at the foot of the bed of her daughter as she was dying, her daughter Paula, who died of porphyria, and then a recent book, The Sum of Our Days, in which Paula is told what has happened in the family since her death. This book seemed to me to be beautifully and impossibly moving. Why? Because we don't know now, I think, how to live. We're living in hard times where nothing is certain. Could it be nothing at all? You know, I witnessed the death just last week of an American genius, David Foster Wallace, who took his own life. Our geniuses are killing themselves. We're living in a dark time. What do we have? This book taught me about the creation of a family. Not just the nuclear family, not just the acts of forgiveness that need to be constantly re-explored and remade, but the forming of an extended family, essentially a tribe, essentially the creation of the community that we no longer have, the community that always is there to come to our aid in sorrow and in great joy. Over the years of talking with Isabel Allende, I have found her to be the person who listens most carefully to an interviewer's most desperate and careful questions. I love her for this, and I welcome her here. Thank you.
It's not working? Yeah, it's working now. Well, thank you so much for showing up. That's half of our lives, just showing up. Show up for the to vote, okay? For Obama. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about The Sum of Our Days because that's the book that was published recently. Actually, I'm working on another book, so to talk about a book that is like past history is rather difficult. And I'm supposed to read from it. I don't write in English, so what I'm going to read is not my work. It's actually my translator's work, which she greatly improves my novels. Let me tell you a little bit how The Sum of Our Days came to be. On January 8th, 2006, it was a stormy, stormy day in the Bay Area, and I had a very restless night, because on January 8th, I start all my books, well, out of superstition and discipline, and I don't dare to change that tradition. And this time, I had prepared a historical novel placed in the Caribbean in the 18th century. But the phone rang, and it was Carmen Balcells, my agent from Spain, who always forgets that she is 9 hours ahead. So I heard her voice on the phone, and she said, "Read me the first sentence." And I said, "There's no first sentence, Carmen. It's 8 o'clock in the morning." And she said, "In that case, write a memoir, Isabel." I already did. I wrote Paula. You don't remember? And she said, "That was in 1993. And since then, a lot has happened to your weird family. I'm sure your readers would like to know more about all of you." She was probably right. People that have never met me before stop me in the street. They want to know about my family. They want to know, for example, if my daughter's widower, Ernesto, found another woman, how many grandchildren I have now, if I have gotten over the sadness of losing my daughter. I tell them that sadness is like a tamed animal that sometimes howls inside me, but in general, we get along fine. Paula's presence is like a soft thing in my heart. And I think that the sadness has become like a very fertile soil in the bottom of the heart where the best things grow. Strength, patience, compassion, humor. I find myself talking to her all the time. So I started thinking about Carmen's idea of a memoir, and it sounded just right. I could talk to Paula, write like a sequel to Paula. And that's how The Sum of Our Days came to be. It is the story of the small tribe that I have put together in Northern California to replace the extended family that I lost 35 years ago in the military coup of 1973 in Chile. I have lived with Willie, my reluctant American husband, for 20 years. And I'm determined to reproduce in the United States the most individualistic society in the world, the communal way of life in which I was raised. Amazingly, this has been a relatively easy pursuit because there is nostalgia for family in this country. I have found several people willing to join my tribe. So now I have an extended family with members that are not blood related and don't even have the same mother tongue. No matter, it functions pretty well. I didn't expect The Sum of Our Days to be the most difficult of all my books. Unavoidably, in these pages, I expose the lives of the people I love the most. I've asked myself frequently how much I needed to tell and how much was not mine to tell. When my son, Nico, heard that I was writing about the family, naturally his first question was, why? Why did I have to reveal our private stuff? I told him not to worry. Probably no one would read it. Then why are you writing it? It's my nature, son. I'm an exhibitionist. Writers write. We can't help ourselves. Also, that's how we make a living. But don't worry, exposing our lives will not harm us. It is not the truth we tell that makes us vulnerable. It is the secrets we keep. Well, mother, I'm sorry that we have a writer in the family, was his conclusion. Life goes by so fast that there is no time to resolve anything unless I write it. Word by word, calmly, I can connect, organize and understand events. That's how I survived the year of my daughter's illness and the pain of losing her. After her death, there was a terrible void in my life. And my mother came with a wise solution that eventually saved me from depression. Write, so that you can accept that death was the only way out for Paula. She gave me back 180 letters that I had written to her during that terrible year of Paula's illness. And based on those letters and the notes I had taken in the hospital, I wrote Paula. I didn't write that book for myself alone. I wanted to share the story with my readers, and I have never regretted it. Of the 17 books I have written, Paula has brought me the greatest response from the readers. Thousands of letters from all over the world keep coming, even today, so long after the book was published. What I don't tell is erased by the winds of oblivion, as it had never occurred. On the other hand, if I repeat a fantasy three times, I end up believing that it really happened. This is what politicians do in the campaign. Beware! Every time I recount something, I modify it a little. So after a while, it's quite different from the original version. Willie says that I have 50 versions of how we met, and I claim that they are all true. In order to keep track of everything in my life, including my dreams, I write to my mother daily. At the end of the year, she gives me back the letters. I have more than 30 years of letters in a dusty armoire. This invaluable correspondence was the foundation for both my memoirs, Paula and The Sum of Our Days. I have often said that if I had to choose between a good story and hurting a relative, I would choose the story, of course. But I was kidding. In a memoir, there is always the danger of exposing other people and freezing them in a role. They can become caricatures. This almost happened to Ernesto, who had the role of my daughter Paula's husband in the book, in the memoir. He remarried, and now he's the proud father of two baby girls, two twins. But for my readers, he will always be the inconsolable widower. Each one of the characters in The Sum of Our Days has a different version of how things happened. And those versions were very different from mine. I listened to them, and whenever possible, I made adjustments in the manuscript. But I didn't buff the edges or paint anything in pastel colors. I deepened and tightened the text, but I refused to polish it to please those who wanted to look good. As a narrator, I want suspense, rhythm, the intricate pattern of human relationships, the luminous and dark moments of our existence. I'm not interested in the gray zones or the fuzzy details. In a memoir, precision is less relevant than atmosphere. Was it summer? Were the tulips in full bloom? I had the manuscript translated into English because most members of my tribe can't read Spanish. I spent a few months waiting while my translator, Margaret Peden, an 82-year-old lady who lives in Missouri, did the translation. When the English version was finished and the family read it, they all came separately to confront me. Some had every page of the manuscript marked in red. Others had only a few shy comments on the margins. Some of them were in tears. Others were furious. In every instance, the book helped us to understand each other better. With my daughter-in-law, Lori, we deepened even more the rare friendship that we share. While my son tolerates my novelistic ways of describing life because he has lived with me for many years, he insisted on refreshing my memory regarding his traumatic divorce and how terribly hurt the whole family was. He had saved some letters that we exchanged during that time when we were so ravaged by emotions that we had to communicate in writing. My stepson, Harley, battled with me for days. He accused me of sucking his blood like a vampire and stealing his life story, so I decided to eliminate his part in the drama, which meant that I had to rewrite the whole book. Too bad. He's a very picturesque character. I rewrote the 400 pages of The Sum of Our Days several times. As I started to unravel the personal stories and the feelings of each person in the book, I questioned my role as the matriarch of the family. I have tried to protect them, but that's a task for the gods. I've not saved them from pain, separation, loss. I've only been able to witness their lives with an open heart. For many, many months, that was all we talked about in our family. Everyone had a chance to express his or her own pain or his or her point of view. And we concluded that we will never agree on the past, but we all agree that we want to remain together. In the meantime, life goes on. The kids are growing up. Everything is changing, and now the sum of our days is ancient history. New stuff happens constantly, and it is too late to add to the book. But I'm saving it in case, maybe in 10 or 15 years, I decide to sum up our days again. And now I will read to you a few pieces from the book. I've chosen some chapters because they are short. But if taken out of context, everything seems strange, you know. That's why I don't like to read from my own writing. This chapter is called Ballroom Dancing and Chocolate. First, I should tell you that I have been in this country for 21 years. I came in 1987 because I was in a book tour for my second or third book translated into English. And when I was passing by San Jose in Northern California, someone introduced me this guy who had read my second book of Love and Shadows, and he liked the book. And so he had come to the reading. And he was introduced to me as the last heterosexual bachelor in San Francisco. He was free that night. And I had been divorced for 3 months. I had been living in chastity for a very long time. 2 or 3 weeks, as I recall. And when he invited me to dinner, there was no time to waste because I had to take a plane. The next day, he took me to the airport, and I asked him on the way, do we have any kind of commitment? I didn't know that you never, ever mentioned the word commitment in front of an American male. He pulled over and said, what are you talking about? We just met. And I said, yeah, but I don't have any time to waste. I'm 45, and I just, do we have a commitment or not? And he said, oh, no, we don't. But I will visit you in December. And I said, December? This is October. And he said, yeah, I'll visit you in December. I said, by December, I may be dead. And he said, why, are you sick? I said, no, I'm not sick, but I live in Caracas, a very dangerous place. So he said, no, we don't have any commitment. Okay, so I took the plane and decided to forget him. But when I got to Venezuela, my son, Nico, was waiting for me at the airport. And he said, you look weird, mother. And I said, yeah, I need to wax my legs and do my hair. I've been traveling for 2 months. And he said, no, you really look weird. And I said, well, I've fallen in love. And he said, in love at your age? With whom? And I didn't fully remember the last name, but I knew that he was called Will. There were no cellular phones then, but there were faxes. And so Nico said, just send him a fax and tell him that you will visit him for a week and then you'd get him out of your system. So I did that. But I sent him a sort of contract by fax. And being a lawyer, he thought it was very funny. The contract had two columns. One column, a long column, the things I wanted from a relationship. And a shorter column about the things I was willing to give. And he thought it was really funny, signed it, and sent it back. So I took a little bag, came to visit, and that was 20 years ago, and I'm still here. 6 months later, I forced him into marriage because I needed a green card. Our relationship has not been easy. There was the cultural gap that you can imagine, and also his life was a mess. He was a project. And I was very arrogant. I thought that I could solve all the problems. You know, this Chilean arrogance. This long introduction. This chapter is called Ballroom, Dancing, and Chocolate. One of the psychologists, we had several at our disposal, recommended that Willie and I share some activities that were fun, not just obligatory. We needed more lightness and entertainment in our lives. I proposed to my husband that we should take dancing lessons because we'd seen an Australian movie on that theme, Strictly Ballroom. And I could already see us whirling in the glow of crystal chandeliers, Willie in a dinner jacket and two-tone shoes, and I in my beaded dress and ostrich plumes. Both of us airy, graceful, moving to the same rhythm, in perfect harmony, as we hope someday our relationship would be. When we had met that unforgettable day in October of 1987, Willie had taken me dancing at a hotel in San Francisco. That gave me the opportunity to bury my nose in his chest and sniff him. And that was why I fell in lust with him. Willie smells like a healthy boy. His only memory of that occasion, however, was that I kept tugging him around. It was like trying to break a wild mare, he told me. It seems to me that he asked, is this going to be a problem between us? And he assures me that I answer in a submissive little voice, of course not. That had been a number of years before. We decided to begin with private lessons so we wouldn't look ridiculous in front of other more advanced dancers. More accurately, I was the one who made that decision. The truth is that Willie was a good dancer in his youth, fawned over and with a winning record in dance contests. And I, in contrast, had all the grace of a truck on the dance floor. The ballroom of the academy had floor-to-ceiling mirrors on all four sides. And the teacher turned out to be a 19-year-old Scandinavian bitch with legs as long as I was tall. She was wearing black stockings with seams down the back and stiletto-heeled sandals. She announced that we would begin by dancing the salsa. She pointed me to a chair, fell in Willie's arms, and waited for the precise beat of the music to launch herself across the floor. "The man leads," was her first lesson. "Why?" I asked. "I don't know, but that's how it is," she said. "Aha," Willie crowed with a triumphant air. "That doesn't seem fair to me," I persisted. "What's not fair about it?" asked the Scandinavian. "I think we should take turns. Willie leads one, and then it is my turn." "The man always leads," the British woman exclaimed. She and my husband glided around the dance floor to a Latin beat as the huge mirrors reflected the interlocked bodies to infinity, the long black stocking-clad legs, and Willie's idiotic smile, while I sat and stewed in my chair. After we left the class, we had a fight in the car that came close to ending in fisticuffs. According to Willie, he hadn't even noticed the teacher's legs or her breasts. That was all in my head. Jeez, how stupid can you be? The fact that I had spent an hour in the chair while he danced was logical, since the man leads. And once he learned, he could guide me around the floor with the perfection of the courting dance of the Huron. Well, he didn't put it exactly that way, but to me, it sounded as if he was mocking me. Our psychologist thought that we should not give up, that ballroom dancing was an effective discipline for body and soul. What did he know? A Buddhist green tea drinker who surely had never danced in his life. But all the same, we went to a second and then a third class before I lost patience and punched the instructor. I have never felt more humiliated. The result was that what little we knew about dancing, we lost. And since then, Willie and I never danced again. I'm recounting this episode only because it is like an allegory of our character. It captures every nuance from head to toe. And now I'm going to read another little piece called The Perverted Dwarf. How politically incorrect a perverted dwarf can be. We were invited to a cocktail party in San Francisco, and I went reluctantly, only because Willie asked me to. A cocktail party is a terrible trial for someone of my stature, especially in a country of tall people. It would be different in Thailand. The best idea is to avoid completely such events. The guests stand around, crushed together with no air, a glass in one hand and a gray hors d'oeuvre in the other. In high heels, I come up to the women's breastbone and the men's belly button. The waiters go by with their trays above my head. There's no advantage in being 5 feet tall, unless that it's easy to pick up things that fall to the floor. And in the era of the miniskirt, I could make dresses from four of my first husband's neckties. While Willie, surrounded with admiring women, devoured prawns at the buffet table and told stories about his youth, such as hitchhiking around the world and sleeping in cemeteries, I dug in a corner so no one could step on me. At these events, I can't take a bite. The things I drop and spill, and those falling from other guests, fly straight to me. That evening, a very amiable gentleman came toward me, and when he looked down, was able to make me out against the pattern of the carpet, and from his Anglo-Saxon heights, offered me a glass of wine. "Hello, I'm David, pleased to meet you." "Isabel, the pleasure is mine," I replied, looking at the glass with apprehension. "You can't get red wine stains out of white silk." "What do you do?" he asked in the spirit of beginning a conversation. Well, the question leads itself to several responses. I could have said that right at that moment I was silently cursing my husband for having me brought, for having brought me to that damn party. But I opted for something less philosophical. I'm a novelist. Really? How interesting. When I retire, I'm going to write a novel, he told me. Is that right? And what is your line of work now? I'm a dentist. And he handed me his card. Well, when I retire, I'm going to pull teeth, I replied. Anyone could say that writing novels is like planting geraniums. I spent 10 hours a day nailed to a chair, turning sentences over 1,001 times in order to tell something in the most effective way. I suffer over the plots. I become deeply involved with the characters. I do my research. I study, correct, edit. I revise translation. And in addition, travel the world promoting my books with the tenacity of a street vendor. In the car, going home, driving over the superb Golden Gate Bridge, bright in the moonlight, I told Willie, laughing like a hyena, what the dentist had said. But my husband didn't see the joke. I'm not planning to wait till I retire. Very soon I'm going to begin writing my own novel, he announced. What? Do you really think that you can compete with me? Why not? He said. Jeez! Can you believe how arrogant some people are? And may I know what your little novel is going to be about? I asked. About an oversexed dwarf. I thought at first that my husband was beginning to catch on to my Chilean sense of humor, but he actually meant it. A few months later, Willie began to write by hand on lined yellow paper. He went around with a pad under his arm and showed what he was writing to anyone who wanted to see it except me. He wrote in airplanes, in the kitchen, in bed, while I teased him unmercifully. A perverted dwarf! What a brilliant idea! The irrational optimism that has served Willie so well in his life once more kept him afloat, and he was able to ignore my Chilean sarcasm, which is like those tsunamis that erase everything in their path. I thought that his literary zeal would evaporate as soon as he found out how hard it is to write, but nothing stopped him. He completed an abominable novel in which a frustrated love, a legal case, and the dwarf were intertwined, confusing the reader who couldn't determine where he was reading a romance, a lawyer's memoir, or a string of repressed adolescent hormonal fantasies. The women friends who read it were very frank with Willie. He should take the bloody dwarf out, and maybe he could save the rest of the book if he rewrote it with more care. The male friends counseled him to take out the romance and go into more detail about the dwarf's depravation. His son, Jason, told him to take out the romance, the courts, and the dwarf and write some stories set in Mexico. Me? Something unexpected happened with me. The dreadful novel increased my admiration for Willie because in the process I could appreciate more than ever his basic virtues, strength and perseverance. As I have learned a few things in the years that I have been writing, at least I've learned not to repeat the same errors, although I always make new ones, I offer my husband my services as editor. Willie accepted my comments with a humility that he doesn't have in other aspects of life and rewrote the manuscript. In my opinion, however, the second version also presented too many fundamental problems. Writing is like magic tricks. It isn't enough to pull rabbits from a hat. You have to do it with elegance and in a convincing manner. Willie sent the book, I don't know to how many editors, and I don't know how many rejection letters he got. And he took it very well. He was getting slowly depressed, which is good because he's very hyper. But he, you know, he's not the kind of man to be deterred by reality. So he kept on knocking doors. One night in bed, I told him, "Look, Willie, why do you write about a perverted dwarf? What do you know about perverted dwarfs? Is this some part of your personality that has been hidden and I don't know about? Is there a dwarf in your life?" We will go back to that question in a moment. I told him in bed that he had been a lawyer for 30 years. He knew a lot about forensic medicine. He knew about crimes, the courts, the law. He had lived in the most beautiful, fascinating city in the world, San Francisco. Why didn't he write Mysteries Placed in San Francisco? And he paid attention to what I said, started writing a book, and I'm very proud to say that The Chinese Jars was published first in Spain, and now it has been published in 9 European languages. Then he wrote his second book called King of the Bottom, that also will be published in Europe, and now he's writing the third, which unfortunately has the dwarf. Willie still doesn't have an American editor, but if there is an editor here, please come to me. Going back to the question of if Willie has a perverted dwarf in his life, he showed the third manuscript, the third mystery, to a friend who reads mysteries and likes very much that genre. And when she finished the book, she said, "Is this character based on your wife?" So I am the oversexed dwarf. You know, I have more to read, but I don't think I will. I think we're going to call Michael and just start a conversation, which probably will be much better than a reading. Okay? Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you. I should hear. With my microphone from this side. Thank you, Michael. It's nice to be with you.
It's a great pleasure to be with you again. I forget how funny you are because when we're talking, I'm so somber that I force you into another mode.
You're not somber.
I wanted to begin by asking, you know, many Americans now facing the question of memoir want to know how true they are, many prominent instances having made this a very difficult subject. James Frey, a woman who pretended to be a member of a Los Angeles gang who came from no gang background whatsoever. I'm sure you and I believe both that literature and memoirs have no particular obligation to truth. But how much do you feel there must be there?
You know, I think that a memoir has an obligation to approach truth as much as possible. Not the facts so much as the spirit of what your life has been. Memoir is always subjective. It's not an autobiography in which facts count. It's the mood. And that is subjective. And that's the problem I had when I confronted my tribe. Because what had a certain mood for me had a different feeling for them. Let me give you an example. My daughter-in-law, whom I adore, by the way, Lori, and I will tell you how I found her. Lori had to go through all the horrible procedure of the fertility drugs because she could not have a baby, and she wanted a baby desperately. And that went on for like 3 or 4 years. And she was really, really sick. And I was with her at her side and my son's side all the time. But when she read that part in the book, she felt that I had totally skimmed the surface and I had not understood her pain. And when she talked to me, I realized that she was right, that because I have had children and because she had three stepchildren, I never quite understood her obsession to become a mother. So my point of view or my way of dealing with it was very superficial, almost frivolous, and that hurt her very much because for her it was the drama of her life. So you see, it's very, very subjective, and I think that you cannot ask the writer of a memoir to be accurate, but you can ask for honesty and truth. I remember that once I was in a panel talking in the Grace Cathedral with Alice Walker and Jean Shinoda Bolen, and I said that writing is lying, that we all lie, otherwise we can't write. And she got very serious, Alice Walker, and she said, no, I think that we write from a place of honesty. And whatever we write, even if it's fiction, it has to come from that place of honesty. And that was a big lesson for me.
In terms of that honesty, we're living in a culture that's almost unimaginable for its levels of dishonesty. How now do we know what honesty is, what it's for, and how does language achieve it?
I can't answer that question, Michael. I think it's very, it's the question of this moment, maybe of this century. Everything needs to change. I think that what we need is like a leap in evolution. It's not anymore about a political party, about a revolution. It's about evolution. And I'm 66 years old. I have lived a long life. I've seen a lot. And when people say that the past was better, it wasn't, let me tell you. It was always worse. We have made progress. We have changed for the better, but always within a certain slow line. We need to leap now. And when I ask myself that question and I say, well, how can we do that? I think that we need to end the patriarchy. We need to get a critical number of women to provide the feminine energy in this moment that we need to keep to have a balance that we have never had. We need that feminine energy to save this planet and to save us as people. And that is to me the beginning of the change we need. And when we talk about honesty, I really think that women are more honest, most women, because they have very little to lose. Women are usually the poorest of the poor in the world. You know, recently I was invited to... I'm sorry, I'm not letting you ask the question.
No, I'm delighted to be hearing you.
Well, recently I was invited to the Melk Abbey in Vienna, near Vienna, to the Watzel Forum, which is a very interesting thing that they do every year. And this was for... the theme was legacy. And they had invited religious leaders from the world. And I was in a book tour, so they had to fly me in a helicopter. It was very bumpy. And I got there really sick and disheveled. And we landed in a soccer field, and there was a car that took me, rushed me into the cellars of the Melk Abbey where they had the lunch. And they had reserved a seat for me next to the Dalai Lama. And so I came, and he said, "You don't look happy." And I said, "I'm going to throw up." And he said, "Helicopter? Ha-ha, papaya, eat papaya." And immediately, a plate of papaya materialized in front of him like a Buddhist miracle. And so I ate papaya from the Dalai Lama's plate, which means that I am halfway through to enlightenment. The theme of that meeting was legacy. All the religious leaders that were there, mullahs, Orthodox priests, monks, well, the Pope wasn't there, but nobody noticed. They were all male. And 51% of humanity is female. There was not one religious leader that was a woman. And so I asked these questions to the Dalai Lama, who answered with this charming laugh. I didn't think it was funny at all. And then when it was my turn to talk, I said, legacy? Legacy? That's a male, that's a penis thing. Only men think that they can control their image, their money, history from the grave. Women don't think that way. And I think that that kind of thinking that is very practical, committed, compassionate, unassuming is what we need now.
We were talking backstage, and I was saying that once again it seemed to me that very interesting novels were coming from South America. In fact, I leaned over and I said, you would think it was El Boom, because this book that's coming out soon by Roberto Bolaño, who, of course, in English did not appear in our language until after his death. The very last book he wrote, called 2666, is coming out in February. It's an amazing book. It's an amazing, amazing, astonishing piece of work. And there's another writer, Horacio Castellanos Moya, a whole series, not a single woman. And I thought, well, how could this be happening again, even given your example? It would seem to me that by now a publisher would know that from the House of Spirits and of, you know, that this is an absolute necessity, that they would not only be fulfilling a literary obligation, but economically as well. There's a vast audience who want to meet the young and new Isabel Allende.
Well, Latin America is still very male chauvinistic, but more women than men all over the world read fiction, and they buy more books. So there is a market out there that the publishers know that it exists. And here in the United States, we have thousands of great women writers. I read a lot of fiction in English, and most of it is by women.
And so how do you account for this? The writing is there.
It's very hard. A woman needs to do double the effort than any man to get half the recognition. And in Latin America, it's even worse. I have recognition abroad that I will never have in my country. In my country, when I go to Chile, for example, it's a social event, never a literary event. And it's hard.
You've spoken to me around a year ago about the Chilean president,
Michelle Bachelet,
who was a woman. And we were speculating. At that time, she had just, in a Catholic country, made birth control automatically and freely available to any young person without parental approval. What has happened since, and how is it going?
Michelle Bachelet has had a very difficult government because she inherited a lot of problems from previous governments. Chile, after the dictatorship, we have had democratic governments, and all of them have been from the Concertación, which is a coalition of parties of the center and the left, which include the Socialist Party, and she is a socialist. So I think that after 17 years, this coalition has stumbled upon many problems. It's a sort of feeling of being tired with power. And there has been corruption, too. And Michelle Bachelet inherited the problem, first of public transportation in Santiago, which is a mess, and corruption, that is also a mess. So she has had a difficult government. And she has been, of course, she has had a lot of opposition from the right And Chile is still a very Catholic country, where the Opus Dei, for example, is very, very strong. And, of course, there has been opposition to this contraception. But it's working. She's doing it. And every pharmacy in the country has to sell it without asking any questions.
Now, as you know, we're facing in this country a very interesting election, mm-hmm. and a terrifying one.
Yeah.
I would think I would be safe to say that almost anyone is afraid of waking up the morning after the ballots,
well,
whoever
least,
we
at
are.
At least half the population is.
Least half. And I'm curious. We have a woman running for vice president who is against birth control, against choice. How do you address that aspect of the feminine energy?
I can't address it because it's not my job to address it. I think it's everybody has to judge for themselves. Do we want to go back in time? It has been so hard after the women's movement to achieve certain rights that we don't. Why would young women want to give up that has been so hard to attain? And I think that she represents the most religious, redneck, backward tendencies in this country. But she has great support. So she represents something that is in the society, obviously. It's very easy to play those forces, you know, because they are always there. It's like racism. It's always there. And people do play that card, too.
I've believed for some time that somehow the people I love and believe in, both emotionally and politically and creatively, allowed the supernatural to leave our hands. They got control of the devil. That is to say, right-wing Christians reinvoked Satan and began a process of exorcism. But our Satan was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We used to scare them with our power, and they stole the irrational from us. The irrational is the basis of all the emotions, and that the Democrats have had a difficulty because we've always been, for the last 10 or 12 years, way too rational, that we need to reinvoke the thing that is our right, the right to instinct, the right to poetry. Do you remember, surely, everywhere we saw when there was a town hall meeting to discuss, someone would strip naked and recite a poem, you know?
I'm too old for that. Too much cellulite.
And it seems to me that what we bring, what creative people bring, is...
However, most creative people stand in the left.
Yes.
So where are they? Where are they?
What happened? What happened to the voice of the artist who knew, the poet who knew, the novelist who knew that we need to, one, create an irrational and unforgettable image, and two, with it, change the future?
You're right.
That's, I think, one of the functions of art. It seems to me that all of the people that you admired and came up among, from Neruda on, were interested in reattaining the rhythm in art that could defeat dictatorship.
Neruda's case was interesting because he was a communist. He was always very political. And he was a very sentimental and sensual poet. But he was always involved in politics, and he was considered by the people the voice of the people in Chile. When we had the military coup, the house of Neruda was closed down by the military, and they put a wooden fence around it, the house in the beach. And it was abandoned for 17 years, and people would come and leave messages on the fence. And the history of 17 years of dictatorship, the history of the pain and the sorrow and the losses and the hope and the struggle was in those messages written with chalk or carved in the wood or left in little pieces of paper between the wood. It's fascinating how when there was this huge repression, he still did represented the people. Then we had democracy. The House of Neruda was open to the public. It was refurbished, remodeled. I've been there many, many times. It's always packed with people that come like they go to a shrine. And it has not lost that quality of speaking for the people. We need that kind of voice.
Now, is it true, really, that he called you the worst journalist in Chile?
I was a lousy journalist.
Do you want to tell the story?
Well, no. It's a boring story. Okay. This was 1973, a month before the military coup, in August, winter in Chile, and Pablo Neruda he had won the Nobel Prize the year before, in 1972, and he had returned to Chile already very sick, and he was living in his house in Isla Negra, this house that I'm talking about. And he called my office and invited me for lunch. I mean, he invited me to visit him. So I was a journalist, and I thought, oh my God, I'm the best journalist in this country. If Neruda is asking me to interview him. So I washed my car, bought a new tape recorder, and went to visit him. In winter, it was a long road then. Now it's easier to get there. And it was a stormy day. It was a good day for him. He was feeling well, and we had lunch with Chilean sea bass and a bottle of white wine. It was very nice. And he showed me his collections of shells and bottles and books and paintings. He collected all kinds of junk. And now it's called collections. Then it was junk. And then after around 3, I saw that he was tired. And I said, okay, Don Pablo, I'm ready for the interview. And he said, what interview? I said, well, I came to interview you. He said, I would never be interviewed by you, my child. You are the worst journalist in this country. You can never be objective. You place yourself in the middle of all the stories. You lie all the time. And I'm sure that if you don't have a story, you make it up. Why don't you switch to literature, where all these defects are virtues?
I think it's true that an artist always recognizes another artist. This is the beginning of the House of the Spirits, yes?
No, this happened in 1973. A month later, we had the military coup on September 11th, 1973. And 11 days after the coup, Neruda died. I went into exile. And I wrote The House of the Spirits in 1981, so it was many, many years later.
And do you find then that the things that he promised you, that you could be at the center of events, that you could make up lies?
Yes. That,
yes.
Yes. I make up lies, but I always keep in mind that idea that it has to have an honest feeling to it. That's why, you know, I remember when I was young, I translated romance novels from the English into Spanish. And, well, It was very embarrassing to translate them, really. So I made a few changes in the dialogue so that the female protagonist wouldn't sound feeble-minded. And then sometimes I got a little carried away and I changed the ending a little too. And I remember that in one of the novels, what was his name? Something like Jeremy Kenfield from Fairfield or something like that. He was a lord. Ended up helping Mother Calcutta in Mother Teresa in Calcutta, while his Cassandra, his lovely fiance, was dealing weapons in the Middle East. And so the publisher didn't revise the translation at all, but when he found out, like 6 months later, I was fired. But my problem with those novels was that I couldn't believe any of it. I don't believe in virgins with big breasts and green eyes that meet these CEOs in Polynesian islands, and they are virgins always, and they are always rich, and they are tough, you know, but inside they're sentimental, and she can change him. That's bullshit. I don't believe in any of that. And I don't believe in happy endings either, so I couldn't do that. I've always wanted to write romance novels because they sell so well. And I would like to be famous like Danielle Steele, but I can't. So what I write, even if it's a pack of lies because it's fiction, it really has to be something that I believe in, that something that moves me, touches me, and forces me to sit down with that story sometimes for years until I get it out of my system. It's really something that hurts me in some way.
Well, you've given me the opportunity to give you the opportunity for an aria. What do you believe in? What are your beliefs? What do you want to express?
I believe in women. I believe in love. I believe that love is the force that moves everything. It moves nature. I believe in pleasure. I was recently at the Omega Institute upstate New York, and one of the speakers was Christiane Northrop, I think it's her. What's the name, the last name? I can never pronounce her name. And she was talking about pleasure. It was a conference about women and courage. And she chose to talk about pleasure. And she said that we are trained to believe that suffering buys us something. That we have to be gloomy. We have to be always struggling with everything. In nature, however, everything moves for pleasure. The beauty of the flower attracts the bee that will pollinize the plant. Sex is all about pleasure. There would be no life without pleasure. And so she said, this part here is what contains the strength of the world. So get up, ladies, all of you, and move like this. Strip naked in front of the mirror and dance. Every time you come in front of the mirror, blow yourself a kiss. To me, it was such a revelation, such a revelation. I believe in that. I believe in joy. I believe in pleasure. I believe that all the suffering in this world, we cause it. We cause it. And it just makes me sick. All that could be stopped if we just could see it, you know? So I believe in that. And I believe also that what we are seeing here is just one flat dimension of reality. There are many dimensions. There is much that we don't control, we can't explain, we can't see, and happens all the time. And the more that we are into science now, the more we discover that things that before were mysterious now have an explanation. But I believe that we will always have mysteries, and we have to be open to that. So in my books and in my life, there is space for the unknown, for mysteries. Let me tell you a little story. When my When my daughter Paula died, we scattered her ashes in the woods. And we went, our little family then, we didn't have the tribe at that point, and we took the children, Alejandro, who was 2 or 2.5, and the baby, Andrea. And each one of them took a little bit of the ashes and scattered it in the woods. So Alejandro knew that those ashes belonged to her aunt. He was around four or five, and we were at home one day, alone, he and I, and I was cooking, and Alejandro came and hugged me, then hugged my knees, and he was very afraid, and he says, there's someone on the stairs, and I said, so I left what I was doing, and I accompanied him, and I said, there's nobody here. He said, there's someone there. There was someone there. So we went around the house, all over the house. There was no one there. And then as we were coming back from the basement, up the stairs, he said, there, she has long hair. And I looked up and I didn't see anything. And I said, that's your Aunt Paula. And he said, she's dead. And I said, that's her spirit. And he said, you told me it was in the woods. How did she get here? In a taxi. And that was perfectly okay with him, you know. She came in a taxi. And yes, I think that she was there. I couldn't see her, but he could. And so I told the story to my son, Nico, who is very rational. And he said, well, the child has heard things. Because everybody was talking in the house about these strange things that were happening in the house. One of the things was that every night, or almost every night, we heard noises as if they were dragging the furniture around. And there were all kinds of explanations. A deer got up on the deck. The old wood in the house is creaking. The pipes. You know, there's always an explanation. And then one day, a professor from the University of San Jose, Celia Correa Zapata, who was writing a book about my books, came, and it was too late for her to go back, so she stayed. And she stayed in the room where Paula had died. And she woke up in the middle of the night with a smell of jasmine. We were in winter. And she said someone was dragging furniture. And I said, yeah, it's the ghost of Paula. And so we laughed about that, and it is in her book, actually. And then we laughed, and nobody paid any attention until one day we had a German journalist stay in the house in the same room. And he said that at night, the bookshelf moved. Now, this is a German male, not a Latin woman. So he had atomic weight. And, of course, then the ghost was officially accepted in the house because of him. So I'm open. Was it a ghost? Was it a deer? Was the German drunk? He had drunk a lot. Who knows?
I want to talk to you about those people who write about your work, because my sense is that your experience of literature from childhood on was about the pleasure of literature. I remember a chest you told me about that had the books of Julio Verne, Jules Verne, and the locked closet in which could be found the 1001 Nights. And I think that we often forget that literature was there as adventure, as romance, as sexual exploit. Even the greatest and most memorable myths are about the gods visiting the earth in order to seduce. Seduction is the theme of the interaction of the divine and the human. And I wondered about that strange impulse that has, in a way, divided literature between the books that are studied in the schools and the books that appear on the bestseller lists.
Sometimes those books that appear in the bestseller list are great literature. I'm not a professor of literature. I never studied literature. And I find myself being studied. And I have, sometimes students are kind enough to send me their thesis. And I have, for example, 4 or 5 about the dog, Barabbas, in the House of the Spirits. One of them says that Barabbas represents the male energy in the house of the book. It's dark and threatening and sexual. And then another one says that he represents the people that will be stepped on by the military. Different theories. Actually, Barabbas was a dog that we had at home. And he was just a dog. And why is he called Barabbas? Well, that was his name. So sometimes people find stuff that I never intended. And other times, I never intended it. And when I'm told, I realize that I did intend it and I didn't know. That happened with Daughter of Fortune. I wrote Daughter of Fortune, which is the story of a young Chilean woman who comes to the gold rush in 1848. And she escapes from Victorian times in Chile, comes to the gold rush, into this male world of violence and greed that was the gold rush, dresses like a man, acts like a man, and finds, she's looking for love, but she finds freedom. And then when she finds that freedom, she goes back to dress like a woman, and she never gives up that freedom, but she can be a woman. That's the story. I thought I was writing about the gold rush or a love story. The first reviewer said that this was the story of feminism. It was the story of women coming out of the restraint of the straitjacket of the house and coming to a male environment, the world, and take it by assault. And then in that process, you have to give up a lot of your femininity in order to compete, to struggle, to survive. And when there is a critical number of women out there, then you can go back to be a woman. And now it's not necessary to go around in a suit with a tie. We can be CEOs in a corporation without the tie. I hadn't thought about it, but that is what my life has been about. It's been about the struggle for a woman to be respected. And that was what I was writing about. I didn't know.
You know, we once spoke of this before. There's a very favorite thing of mine, Gertrude Stein, who was herself a feminist and who loved the feminists that preceded her, wrote an opera about Susan B. Anthony, who was a suffragette and fought for women's votes in America. Let's remember that women's votes is not that far in the past. I mean, it's within living memory of certain French people I've learned that women got the vote in France. It's within our lifetime. It's a right, like the right to abortion, that can be taken away.
And it is taken away as soon as you have a fundamentalist regime or a crisis of any kind.
And so Gertrude Stein has written this opera, The Mother of Us All, about Susan B. Anthony, and they win the vote, and Susan B. Anthony's girlfriend says to her, "You must be very happy now, Susan." And Susan B. Anthony says, "I don't know, because now women will be more like men. The more we fight, the more things we gain that are the things that men have and need and use to legislate the world, will we still be women? How will we preserve the nature of being the underdog? In other words, the enormous strength that comes of and from the oppressed. Not that anyone wants to continue to be oppressed, but the things that we see in the world always, who didn't want a homeland for the persecuted Jews who fled the Nazis, but who wants to see the terrible things that are being done to the Palestinians? Who hasn't watched over and over and over again in the world
the story of the underdog becoming the overdog and repeating the pattern of oppression.
I think that in the case of women, that's why I was talking before about a critical number. If you have a few women in power, they act like Thatcher. They are men with skirts. But if you have enough women, and what one of the things that the women's movement did achieve was to transform the younger men, and there has been an acknowledgement of the feminine in men that wasn't there before. And that is something really important. Still, women are still the underdog, are still poor. Women do 2/3 of the labor in the world, and they have 1% of the assets. So we are still, by far, the underdog.
Wait. Real figures?
Absolutely, I'm not making them up. I mean, you can check. You can check. I make up other things, but not this. Although, I have, sometimes. Now I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry.
You interrupted me. And my Alzheimer's is kicking in. I think that we still are the underdog. We still have that energy. It will not happen for a long time that we become the oppressor. And I don't think that patriarchy should be traded for matriarchy. It won't make any difference. We need a balanced management of the world.
You mentioned that you are already, another January 8th has passed, and you are already working on a new book. And you are a seasoned enough writer to know when something is working. Can you tell us about what it is without jeopardizing it?
It's been a very difficult book because it's about slavery. And I don't know why I'm writing it and why I have been obsessed with something that it's more of the African-American culture and more a theme that almost has been exclusively either from the south of the country or African-American. But I'm not writing about the United States. I'm writing about slavery in what is today Haiti and was then a colony of France called Saint-Domingue. And so my book starts there. And it was probably the most horrible kind of slavery that has ever existed in the world. And researching it has been quite an ordeal. Just to know what people are able to do with other people. First, the concept that you can own another human being. And then the cruelty, the incredible cruelty that we are capable of if there is enough power and impunity. And this is why I'm always horrified when I see people that justify torture. They never put themselves in the case of a person who is tied up, impotent, in the hands of another person who can do with him whatever they want. And this is what slavery was. They could sell your children. They could cut your hands. They could kill you if they want in the most horrible and slow way, with total impunity. So I think that what I fear the most is power, the power to abuse, and the abuse of power.
A final question. I'm very curious. Writing involves so much solitude, and you've spoken of times in your life in which you have retreated to a closet, or even, in fact, only had a closet to write in. And I think of power as being a very public kind of transaction. All of us need to keep in balance as well, it seems to me, the relation between the imagination, which is private, and power, which is public, that we
are suffering in this country from a public disrespect for the imagination as we fail to fund our arts and our artists, as we discover that fewer and fewer publishers want the work of really original fiction writers, as we have political events that don't contain poets standing up to read their work. So I wondered if you could finish by talking about the relation for you of imagination to power.
I have discovered in my life the power of the written word. I had no idea. When I started writing The House of the Spirits, it was like a message in a bottle, and it goes in the sea, and you never know which shores it will reach or who will read it. And in time, in these 20-something years that I've been writing, I realized the power of that message in a bottle. I find that something that is written and some other person reads has an impact, good or bad or whatever, in that person that the author can never estimate. We never know what will happen. That's why I'm so careful sometimes. I am explicit with a sex scene, and I'm very careful with a torture scene because I don't want to put ideas in anybody's head. For example, now that I'm editing, correcting my final manuscript of this book, I'm cutting all the parts that are explicit because I want the reader to know the brutality, but I don't want the reader to know the details. So because I know the power of the written word. I know the power of imagination. In my own life, what imagination has done. I'm sitting here with you because I have had the wonderful opportunity of let my imagination fly. Most people don't. Most people are stuck in menial work, repeating the same thing over and over. All children have imagination. By age 7, half of them don't, because we manage to put them in a place where they can't expand that imagination. I have one granddaughter, Andrea, who is weird. And she has always been weird. And I look at her with such understanding and compassion because she is like I was, but she's living in much better times. So she can be herself. She can express herself. She can have jeans with poems written all over. And her she dresses strange and she has poems written all over. And I couldn't do that when I was a child. I belonged to a generation and to a gender that was not allowed that. And she can do it. So I think that she will have that incredible power. You're right. We need the poets, we need the writers, we need the painters, we need the photographers. You know, the power of art has... What is art? Art has the capacity to summarize the human experience, the collective experience, and create a moment, an image that becomes an icon and summarizes a time or an event. For example, that little girl running like this in Vietnam, naked, burning, and the napalm burning in her behind her. That image that we've all seen, that photograph, summarizes the war, summarizes a time, and it becomes a work of art, a masterpiece. And the guy who took the snapshot wasn't thinking that he was doing something that would become that icon. That other picture that we've seen so many times of that woman that has those green eyes that we've seen in National Geographic, the woman from Afghanistan, she's an icon. She doesn't know that she's an icon. She doesn't know that she's in the cover of every photography book in the world. What happens with painters, that Guernica, for example, by Picasso, summarizes the civil war in Spain. You know, in nature, a lot is wasted. In order to have one seed to germinate and become a plant, nature spends generously. Thousands and millions of seeds die without germinating, but one does. Nature spends. We don't spend in art. We don't spend enough to have that seed germinate and flower and become something wonderful. We don't. So we expect that the bestseller will be the icon. Usually it isn't. It's the quiet little writer or painter or photographer that is hidden in some attic somewhere, starving, that will create that thing that we need at this time. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.